Hi, I'm John Wheeler, and welcome to episode number 42 of This Week in Nuclear. This podcast focuses on news, facts, and commentary on how nuclear energy will make our world cleaner, safer, and less reliant on fossil fuels. Before I get into the show, I want to apologize to my listeners for the extended absence. It's been over a month since my last episode of This Week in Nuclear, and I hate going that long without a show. Things with my job and personal life have been very hectic, good, but very busy, and I just haven't had time to get an episode out. That being said, I'll do my best to stay more consistent in the future, and if that means shorter episodes, then perhaps that's what I'll try. Anyway, on with the show. You know, there are a lot of people in Australia who would like to continue to perpetuate that nation's reliance on coal as their primary large-scale energy source, especially since last year when Prime Minister John Howard issued his report that promotes nuclear on several fronts. This government study concluded late last year that nuclear energy is cost competitive with coal in Australia, and if some kind of carbon trading system is put into place, then nuclear is even cheaper than coal. Well, the anti-nuclear groups and the coal lobby don't like those conclusions, so they brought in a hand-picked panel of so-called experts to find holes in the report. The panel included a former U.S. NRC Commissioner Peter Bradford. It's interesting, though, because the most significant difference of opinion raised by the external experts was a time frame in which nuclear plants could be built. The original report states that plants could be online in 10 to 15 years, and the external panel said that that is unlikely. Now tell me this, if nuclear plants can be built around the world in 40 to 50 months, why would it take Australia more than 10 years to do it? Heck, China is building close to 40 nuclear plants in the next 25 years. There are certainly no technical barriers to building that many nuclear plants. There are certainly no technical barriers to getting one or two nuclear plants built within 10 to 15 years, only political ones. And you can rest assured that the coal industry and the Labour Party in Australia and the anti-nuclear groups will do everything in their power to stretch out the time frame as long as they can. It's somewhat of a self-fulfilling prophecy. The anti-nuclear groups claim that nuclear plants take too long to build. Then they do everything in their power to slow the process down through political and legal battles. Then they gain the right to say, "I told you so." I hope that when Australia embarks on building nuclear plants, that they put in place some controls to prevent that from happening. Another angle of attack is to spread fear of negative economic consequence in regions where nuclear plants might be built. For example, Queensland Tourism CEO Daniel Gishwin says nuclear plants and tourism are, quote, not compatible, and he predicted dire economic impact to coastal towns like Townsville that rely heavily on tourism as their primary source of income. I have to say, this is the stupidest argument I've heard yet. There are nuclear plants all over the world in key tourist destinations. I've never heard of any adverse impact. There are some nuclear plants in the United States that I'm familiar with that are close to tourist destinations. For example, Turkey Point near Miami in the Florida Keys. Now, I've never heard of anyone deciding not to go to Miami or South Beach or to vacation in the Florida Keys because Turkey Point's there. Then you have Oyster Creek on the South Jersey Shore, one of the most heavily visited tourist destinations on the east coast of the United States, and San Onofre on the California Pacific Coast. And if you think about it for just a minute, you'll agree. Would you alter your vacation plans if you knew there was a nuclear plant somewhere nearby? Of course not. Tourists know that in the unlikely event that there's any kind of problem from a nuclear plant or from any other reason, that they can pack up and go home. The same article said they were afraid that the nuclear plant would cause accelerated destruction of the coral reefs. One thing that I haven't mentioned on the show before is that I love diving and I love the sea, and I'm a marine engineer. T- to me, it's a ridiculous argument that nuclear power plants would cause destruction of the coral reefs when you consider tons of mercury, sulfur dioxide, and arsenic that are dumped into Australia's air every day by coal plants. All those contaminants make their way into creeks and rivers that discharge into the sea. Nuclear plants emit none of those deadly contaminants. It's true that thermal discharge from nuclear plants can be a problem, but that's true of any power plant, not just nuclear plants. And if the plant is designed properly, then thermal discharge is not a problem. In fact, in most places, the fish flock to the areas by the outfall because the water is warmer. Fishermen know that, and if you go by a power plant, you'll almost always see one or two fishing boats in the discharge canal. That reminds me of another interesting story I read in the last couple of weeks. Technicians at Indian Point Nuclear Plant in New York are doing some sampling along the Hudson River to determine if there's any measurable strontium-90 coming from the plant. Well, they didn't find any strontium in the river from the plant, but you'll never guess what they did find. While all the samples were barely detectable, samples taken more than 20 miles upstream of the plant had higher levels of strontium than those taken around the plant and downstream. So what does that tell you? Well, it could be several things. The levels measured were low, so there could be statistical variations in the samples. Or there could be other sources of strontium upstream that are far greater sources than Indian Point's minuscule leak. In fact, there's a lake a few miles from the Hudson River in Dutchess County, New York, called Nuclear Lake. And I don't know all the details, but years ago, the U.S. government did some kind of nuclear weapons research and production. That's probably an unlikely source. But further upstream, near Albany, New York, there are Department of Defense experimental and test reactors at Knowles Atomic Laboratory on the Mohawk River. That's a tributary to the Hudson. If the strontium samples turn out to be valid upstream of Indian Point, then that's where I would look to places as possible sources. There's also the possibility that the samples reflect runoff from decades-old weapons testing fallout. Again, the amounts that we're talking about are incredibly small and pose absolutely zero risk to aquatic life or to the environment in general. In another story from Australia, police near Sydney arrested a group of homegrown terrorists who had a rocket-propelled grenade and launcher. The police said that the group was planning to attack several targets in Sydney, including the Research and Medical Isotope Reactor at Lucas Heights. Now, why a terrorist group would seek to target a research reactor is beyond me. These are not high-powered explosives, and they'd be unlikely to cause any real damage. Case in point, if you remember a few weeks ago, a rocket-propelled grenade was fired at the U.S. Embassy in Athens, Greece. It hit a wall of the parking garage next to the embassy and did no damage. I find it interesting that the newspaper headlines the fact that the reactor was a target, but it doesn't mention any of the softer targets that were also on the hit list, things like hotels, office buildings, etc. An attack on any of the other targets would have had a much higher chance of hurting someone than to shoot at a hardened industrial facility such as Lucas Heights. Media bias against nuclear energy is found in many forms, and this is an example of newspapers sensationalizing stories associated with nuclear reactors and choosing to ignore the real concerns in the story. There's an interesting feud taking shape in Eastern Europe between Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and Poland. Last year, the four nations agreed to form a joint venture and to finance and build a new nuclear plant at the Ignalina site in Lithuania. Apparently, the original discussions were about a four-way even split of the cost and of the power that will be generated by the plant. Now Lithuania is arguing for a greater share of the energy. That's a tough position to take for any one of the four partners because the plant will come online in 2015 just as forecasts predict a serious energy shortage in the region. Lithuania suffered the same fate as Bulgaria. They were forced by out-of-date agreements with the European Union to shut down older reactors as a condition of gaining entry to the Union, and now they need to replace those nuclear plants. The entire region is subservient on Russia for natural gas, and nuclear energy offers the best hope of ridding them of that dominance. Even Sweden and the Czech Republic have expressed interest in getting involved in that project. They need more energy too. There's a relatively easy solution to the problem, isn't there? Just build more nuclear plants. That way each nation can get their share of the energy they need to keep their economies growing and the standard of living rising. And they can do it without contributing to global warming. And since I'm talking about Europe, I have to spend some time on what's going on in Bulgaria. In the past, I've talked about the injustice being done to Bulgaria by the European Union, who demanded the closure of Kozloduy Units 3 and 4. Well, on December 31st, 2006, at about 10 p.m. in the evening, 2 hours before the deadline, operators at Kozloduy shut down the units, and in doing so turned Bulgaria into a net importer of energy. When the two nuclear units were running, they were an exporter of energy to the surrounding nations. In fact, they exported 7.8 billion kilowatt hours of electricity in 2006 and filled 80% of the energy deficit in the region. This is mind-boggling in light of the European Union's report on climate change and energy that was released in January of 2007. In the report, the European Union acknowledges that it will be almost impossible to meet CO2 emissions targets while simultaneously shutting down nuclear plants. This may be a hard pill to swallow in places like Germany, where years ago the Green Party pushed through a program to phase out nuclear altogether. Bulgaria is not taking the shutdown of Kozloduy sitting down. They're fighting in every way they can. In fact, now that they're officially European Union members, they're using their new status to lodge a petition before the European Union executive body. The European Union has offered Bulgaria 570 million euros in compensation for shutting down the units. One report that I read states that Bulgaria will seek to increase that amount to 1 billion euros if the plants are not allowed to restart. Here's an interesting development. Pakistan announced a few weeks ago that they're working with the International Atomic Energy Agency to couple seawater desalination equipment to the 125 megawatt Kainup nuclear plant near Karachi, Pakistan. The desalination skid will produce 1,600 cubic meters of potable water per day. I'm impressed by the quantity of drinking water that will be produced by this relatively small nuclear plant. 1,600 cubic meters per day. They're calling the project the Nuclear Desalination Demonstration Plant, or NDDP, and they stated that engineering work is complete and construction is underway. Kainup is a CANDU reactor, and the desalination equipment will use extraction steam diverted from the unit's feed water heaters. In January, the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to consider an appeal by Pacific Gas and Electric in a legal battle between the utility and anti-nuclear groups who argued that the NRC, or Nuclear Regulatory Commission, should have considered the threat of terrorist attack in their environmental impact review of dry cask storage at the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant. Here's a summary of the case. Diablo Canyon, like so many other nuclear plants in the U.S., applied to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for a license to build a dry cask storage facility for their used nuclear fuel. During the process, anti-nuclear groups argued that the NRC should consider the potential impact of a large-scale terrorist attack, such as a bomb or a 9/11-style airliner attack. After reviewing the case thoroughly, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission denied the petition because of the remote possibility of such an attack, and because, with the robust design of the structure of nuclear power plants, such an attack would not cause serious damage. The NRC also decided that the terrorist threat should be addressed by the Atomic Energy Act and not by the National Energy Policy Act, as the anti-nuclear groups claimed. The NRC issued the license for the dry cask storage facility, and the utility began construction. Anti-nuclear groups didn't like that answer, and they filed a lawsuit in the California Appellate Court. The Appellate Court ruled in favor of the anti-nuclear groups. They stated that the NRC violated the National Environmental Policy Act when they failed to include the possibility of such a terrorist attack in the environmental impact report for the dry cask storage facility. The utility appealed the appellate court's ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court. and 2 weeks ago the Supreme Court decided not to hear the case. This means the appellate court's ruling will stand. And this puts the ball back in the NRC's court. They'll have to decide how they'll consider the National Energy Policy Act and environmental impact analysis of license applications. It's unsure how this will affect future licensing actions, but it could have far-reaching effects. The same argument could be applied to other cases, and it might be expanded to include applications for operating license extensions and even for new nuclear plants. The NRC is reportedly considering how to respond to this recent development, so the industry is in a bit of a wait-and-see situation. This is an important case for a couple of reasons. The most obvious one is the potential impact of future licensing actions. The more subtle, but probably far-reaching impact, is this could be viewed by investors as a test of the NRC and of the new licensing process. There's a lot of concern that regulatory uncertainty will discourage investors from backing new nuclear plants in the United States, and the threat, or even the perception, of continuously evolving licensing standards could have a significant impact on new construction plans. Well, that's all the news for this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. If any of you are out there in the nuclear industry, there's a conference next week in Jacksonville, Florida. It's called the Conference on Nuclear Training and Education, or CONTI for short. I'll be at that conference, so if you're there, please look me up. I'll be participating in the conference in a couple of ways next week. I'll be doing a talk on workforce analysis tools, and I'll be participating in a panel discussion on developing talent pipelines for startup engineers for new nuclear construction. Anyway, if you're at the CONTI conference in Jacksonville next week, please look me up. Once again, thanks for listening to This Week in Nuclear. This is John Wheeler. Have a great week.